Okay, welcome to this seminar in the Cañada Blanca Centre. I am not Paul Preston, unfortunately. Paul is indisposed and can't be here, so he asked me to take his place to chair this seminar. I was the Deputy Director of the Cañada Blanca Centre once upon a time, so I think that's one of the reasons he asked me. Now, I don't have the wit or the charisma of Paul, so there may be a rush to get out, because I'm the one chairing it. But don't worry, because we have Dr. Boris Volodarsky here. Some of you may remember the talk he gave in November, his absolutely fascinating talk about Spaniards in the NKVD and the murder of Trotsky, a reassessment. Well, today he's going to talk about the title that you will know, but let me repeat it, Conundrum, Soviet, British and American Intelligence in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. Now, so I'm delighted to invite Boris to talk to us once again. You may know, or let me certainly repeat it, even if you do, that Boris is a former GRU Special Operations Agent. He's now a leading intelligence expert and a consultant for private risk companies across the globe. And his work has covered countless major news outlets, the BBC, ITV, Times, Telegraph, to name just a few. His own works include several articles in journals, or many articles in journals, I think I should be saying. And his books include the KGB's Poison Factory, from Lenin to Litvinenko, and most recently Assassins in 2018. And he's here today primarily because of his long association with the centre. He did his PhD thesis under Paul Preston and is now a research fellow of the centre. He's always been interested in the Spanish Civil War, which formed part of his 2015 book, Stalin's Agent, The Life and Death of Alexander Orlov. This paper focuses on new research on Spain, which is part of a wider project on Western intelligence over the Civil War. So Boris, without more ado, can I pass the mantle on to you?
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's a great, great pleasure to see you here again. And I'm very grateful to Professor Balfour for the introduction. And as long as the Cañada Blanca Centre exists here, I believe Paul Preston is always with us. At least I'm his pupil, so he's in this or that way anyway present. I'm not going to tell you a lot of spy stories today. Actually, I'm not going to tell you almost no spy stories today. I must tell you that I have been working on this lecture for 3 months. And the topic, Russian intelligence in the Spanish Civil War is, of course, known to me because half of my Orlov book, which is almost 1,000 pages, is about Russian intelligence in the Spanish Civil War, which is a fascinating subject. We talked with several specialists, like Paul Preston, like Angel Venus and Richard Parks and others, about the topic, and found out that almost nothing is known about the activities of Western intelligence services in the Spanish Civil War. Actually, I asked Paul Preston what he knows, and said, "Paul, nothing is known." So I started to study the topic, which made one chapter now of my upcoming book, and the upcoming book is called Between Stalin and Franco, Freemasons, Communists, and Intelligence Services in the Spanish Civil War. And I do hope to be able in autumn this year to make another seminar here, with permission of Paul and Susanna, about Freemasons in the Spanish Civil War, which is an absolutely fascinating and entirely unknown subject, except that they were persecuted very much. But it's very interesting indeed. So I might tell you more about it next time. About intelligence services, I made two very interesting discoveries about which we shall talk today. Working on the subject on Russian intelligence services and Western intelligence services, I found out that besides the general difficulty and problems working on any historical subject, it's much more difficult to work on the history of intelligence and on specifically on intelligence services, because the aim of the government, of every government, Russian, American, British, whatever, is to conceal the truth, not to tell anybody about what's going on, because the service is based on two principles. On the principle is secrecy and deception. So it's almost impossible, actually, to learn anything properly, and there are many historians who are doing research, but what I found out, researching a lot for many years in the National Archives, for instance, that even intelligence service files cannot be relied on for many reasons. First, information that comes inside is very flawed in most of the cases. Second thing, which is very surprising, and that intelligence services were not up to date on many subjects. For example, when Walter Krivitsky, a known figure to many of you, of course, defected in 1940 and was telling British services, MI6 and MI5, about the structure of Russian NKVD at the time, about spies employed in Europe, about operations and other things, they were recording everything, and one of the best historians of all times in intelligence history, Christopher Andrew, wrote in his official history of MI5 that British services learned a lot about the structure of Russian secret services, about secret operations, about agents involved, etc., etc., etc. While after 14 years of research, which was related to my work on Orlov, I found out that Krivitsky knew absolutely nothing. And what he told the British services during his interrogations in London is absolutely untrue, completely invented. I mean, everything, every person, every operation, every department, every activity, every structure, everything is invented. And it's all in the files. So whenever anybody is working with intelligence files, one has to be extremely careful, because information contained there is not always correct, and sometimes is entirely incorrect. And we shall come to one interesting case later today. In his famous and classic book, which is The Spanish Civil War, Paul Preston is writing that to a large extent the reaction of foreign powers dictated both the course and the outcome of the Civil War. And another great historian, very famous Spanish historian, Enrique Maradielos, he wrote that specifically the policy of Britain played a great role influencing the events, the course and the outcome of the Spanish Civil War. What surprised me after a long time of research is that this war was one of the very rare cases when intelligence played no role at all in any decision making. Absolutely no. I mean, intelligence was not even considered when the policy makers, decision makers were making this or that decision in relation to the Spanish Civil War, to the behavior, to the diplomacy, to the relations, what to do, even militarily, not to mention anything else, which is very strange and unusual. But the traditional way today for the experts is to divide intelligence services that were, or powers that were involved in the Spanish Civil War, into two groups. One group is called democracies, which is Britain, France, and the United States, who were not taking part in the Spanish Civil War, but whose observers were closely, intelligence observers, were closely observing the events. And three so-called totalitarian powers, or dictatorships, as they usually know, which is Germany, Italy, and the Soviet Union, who were directly involved in the Spanish Civil War, whose military representatives, armies, technique and intelligence officers were directly involved in the Spanish Civil War. Interestingly, there were quite a lot of intelligence services operating on each side. For example, the French were having 6 intelligence services operating in this direction. 2 of them are rather well known. It's the so-called French Deuxième Bureau and Service Spécial, which is the Service de Renseignement, French Secret Service, which is part of the War Ministry. And Deuxième Bureau is also part of the War Ministry, but they were part of the General Staff. Interestingly, they were not sending any spies, not recruiting any spies to in Spain. They were operating through their military attachés in Spain and in Russia. That was the way to get information. With America, it's even worse, because the United States, they didn't have any intelligence services until 1947. And so all information that they were getting was coming from the military attachés. Interestingly, the most interesting topic for the research for every intelligence services in the Spanish Civil War was the aviation. Air problems, aviation problems, aerial attacks, technical specifications of airplanes were of primary importance of interest to every intelligence service that operated during the Spanish Civil War. But the only air attaché of the United States accredited in Europe was actually accredited in Paris. Two military attachés who were accredited in Madrid and later Valencia, they were from the infantry. So they knew very little. They were very actively reporting. What I found out working on the subject is that today we know absolutely everything what all intelligence services collected in Spain. All. At the time, in 1939, the government knew very little of what their intelligence services collected, and what they knew they didn't take care of and were not interested, I tell you at once. In this country, there were air ministry was involved in active intelligence activities in Spain, Royal Air Force. They were acting separately. In the air ministry, there was a department which was called AI, which was collecting intelligence, and Royal Air Force was doing that separately. Admiralty was collecting intelligence, and the Royal Navy separately. The War Ministry, they had several departments that were involved in this or that way. It was called the Directorate of Military Operations and Intelligence that were trying to collect some intelligence in Spain. There was the Foreign Office, of course, who were employing also two directions. They were acting via Secret Intelligence Service and via diplomats and consuls accredited in Spain. And there was another interesting network, which is almost entirely unknown, which was the so-called Private Intelligence Bureau headed by Sir Robert Vansittart. He had his private intelligence network that was operating worldwide, also involving Spain, and we shall talk about it also a little bit later, quite interestingly, but entirely, almost entirely unknown. In terms of this country, they were not working together. All those intelligence organizations were not working together. They were, first of all, the foreign ministry was against accrediting anybody with Franco for political reasons. So there were visits, private visits, by members of parliament, by some military men to the Franco side. Then they came back to London and were telling what they saw. that was kind of a source of intelligence. MI6, which you know as MI6. By the way, do you know why is it called MI6? Does anybody know? No. It's very interesting. I just found out for myself recently. It was the Department of the War, War Ministry, War Office. There was a series of departments in the War Office, and there was MI1, MI2, MI5, MI6, MI7, MI9, etc., etc., etc. And one day in 1912, Department MI1C became known as Secret Service. That is, the Secret Service Bureau, which existed from 1909, joined with the War Office Department MI1C, and it started to be called after a while Secret Intelligence Service, but both names were used. The name MI1C and Secret Intelligence Service until 1941, 42, about this time. So both were actual. At a certain period, MI6 was one of the departments of the War Office. The task of the department was the liaison relations with Secret Service, with Secret Intelligence Service, or Secret Service Bureau, or with the department MI1C. And one day, during the Second World War already, they decided to, because as you know very well, until the 80s, Secret Intelligence Service did not exist officially. Never existed. There was no one was registered. There were no budget. It did not exist. It had considerable budget and enough people, but officially it did not exist. So they decided, just out of the blue, because there was one War Office department named MI6, which was not necessary to exist anymore. So they said, why don't we call Secret Intelligence Service MI6? So nobody could guess what it is. And that's now more or less the official name, but of course it's an incorrect name of the Secret Service. The correct name is Secret Intelligence Service, as it was called almost from the first day. And the chiefs, from the very first chief until today, they're called the Chief of Secret Intelligence Service. But still, this strange secret name, MI6, still exists. What is strange in the time of the Spanish Civil War? You probably know that Secret Intelligence Service was represented worldwide, again, very secretly, by passport control offices. So passport control offices were those representatives of the Secret Service, British Secret Service, who were operating in every country. What I found out, and that involved a lot of research. I was talking to Paul Buchanan from Oxford University, from Jill Bennett, who was the official historian of the Foreign Office, from many people. There was no passport control office in Spain. There was an embassy headed by Sir Chilton, whose deputy was Ogilvy Forbes, who became an acting ambassador in Spain after Chilton moved to Hendaya, to France, to the French territory. But there was no passport control officer. There were consuls, like a famous consul, Sir Norman King, who was in Barcelona since 1928 until almost the end of the war, for 10 years, almost 10 years, or more actually. He was from 26, for 12 years he was in Spain. There were other people, other diplomats who knew Spain well. There were two mysterious consuls, one in Algeciras, whose name is Beckinsale, and one consul whose personality I'm still working on, with the help of many, many researchers and specialists in this or that branch. His name is Milanes. He was deputy consul in Madrid and then became acting consul in Madrid. Juan Henke Milanes, and nothing is known about him, absolutely nothing. So the idea is that he might have been representing Secret Intelligence Service, but officially There was no passport control office, as I said, and Secret Intelligence Service was not represented in Spain. Therefore, nothing more or less is known about the activities, because there were no activities. They were not able to get any information from the Republic in Spain. They were not admitted to operate on the Franco side, and they collected no intelligence. So, War Office, Air Ministry, and Admiralty, with, as I mentioned, Royal Air Force, Royal Navy, and military attachés, they were collecting military intelligence, and there were permanent complaints. Why I am saying that there was no information, no intelligence coming? Because, first of all, as we now know from Michael Goodman, who is the official historian of the Joint Intelligence Committee, which is the head office where all intelligence comes, we know that in the 30s, the official definition of intelligence was military intelligence. There was no political intelligence, and no espionage as it is. The thing which was collected during the Spanish Civil War was technical data on Italian and German arms, armaments, strategy and tactics. That was the main concern of the British government and all interested organizations. Russia was of no interest at all. Russian Navy was considered backward. It was incomparable with Britain. Russian aviation was considered backward to compare with German aviation. Russian technology, industry and everything was incomparable, and it was no risk. The risk was Russian propaganda and subversion. That was what interested, to a certain extent, Britain intelligence, in represented by MI5, which is a security service, and SIS, which is a secret intelligence service. There were reports in March, for example, from Morocco and from Gibraltar and from Algeciras, saying that Russians transferred several million pounds to the Communist Party of Spain. There was information that a Russian cargo ship arrived with arms. That was in March 1936, that is several months before hostilities started. The report was probably concocted by consul in Algeciras, making sale, and was dismissed by the service as of having no interest. They simply reported to the Deuxième Bureau, to the French colleagues, that, as expected, the center, the Comintern, Communist International Center in Paris, is financing the Communist Party of Spain and is continuing with this subversive work, and asks the French colleagues to watch out, to which the French service did not even respond. The Russian intelligence was also interested. Yesterday I received a fascinating volume, which was published virtually several days ago, and just to my great luck, somebody was flying yesterday, was flying from Moscow, so I managed to ask, and was brought this volume. It's that thick volume, which is called Russian Intelligence Reports from the Spanish Civil War, from all the Russian archives. So even that is known. That's an author, an American author, whose name is James Cortada, who published the book, Modern War in Spain, something like that, where all reports of all American intelligence offices, all military attachés, of all reports from day one until the last day, until 39, April 39, all reports are in this book. The Russian book includes all military reports, because the Russian military, they were, as other military intelligence services, only interested to know how Italians and how Germans were operating in Spain, what airplanes they used, what tanks they used, what was the strategy. The British were interested exclusively, almost, in the air doctrine, because at the time, a popular figure of the time was a person whose name was Captain Little Heart. And he was writing articles. He was a journalist, basically, an army journalist, but he is considered to be a theoretician in all military matters. And his idea was that in the future war, and of course everybody was preparing for the future war, they realized that Germany is a danger. So in the future war, Britain should put more attention or special attention or all attention to aviation. So the concept was taken up by Chamberlain, by Churchill, by many other leaders of the country, and aviation was paid special attention. Besides the Joint Intelligence Committee, which was created in July 1936, there was, after hostilities broke out in Spain, there was another committee, much less known, created, which was called GICS, where S was standing for Spain. And this committee was headed by Wing Commander Goddard, who was heading, his position was DDI-3, which is Deputy Director of Intelligence for Air Ministry 3, department which was responsible for Iberian Peninsula. So there was a special subcommittee with the government that was to analyze, collect, process, and distribute all intelligence coming from Spain. But the main stress was put on aviation and on the relationship between, there was even a principle, air versus warships or battleships, where the role of aviation in comparison with the Navy was very much investigated, because the Royal Navy thought that aviation should play one role, and the Air Ministry thought the aviation should play another role, and so they were competing, and one was trying to collect information, which turned out to be of no value to the government for the Navy and another for the aviation. As a result, it was found out that Britain took no lessons of the Spanish Civil War, simply. And the only country which is considered to be profited greatly from the lessons of the Spanish Civil War is Germany, and their tactics of the Blitzkrieg, of the use of aviation together with the defensive forces and a lot of other special military things were much used by them during the war in Europe and even during the first part of the campaign in Russia. While Britain, France and the United States draw no lessons from the war, which is rather strange, but they had to respond for it later when the war really started and Britain had to act as the solo country against Germany. As I already said, MI6 practically had any operations, no agents in Spain, and only one. They managed in late 1936 to bring one person whose name is Hamilton Stokes. They credited him in Gibraltar, and he was trying to get to organize some information, to get some sources from Gibraltar, and he was the only official intelligence officer who was accredited on this territory on behalf of MI6. Still, there was one interesting trick that I found out. But before, those who were present here during the talk by Jim Burns, and how many of you were present at his talk? He was telling you were present. He was, I don't know whether he told you the story about, he was definitely telling you about his father, naturally, and about spy games that were after the Spanish Civil War, which were not a lot. And interestingly, once we were having a seminar in the Foreign Office, and there were historians, MI6 historians present at this seminar, and there was sort of presentation of his book, and they were saying, look, whatever concerns espionage and spy operations, it's always written that this book is not exactly true. I don't know whether Jim was telling you about the man whose name was Dennis Coven. Did he tell you anything about it? It's an interesting figure. And one very respectable historian of the Spanish Civil War, he was writing, he has plenty of books on the Spanish Civil War, mainly Spanish, but a lot of English chapters, books and things. He wrote an interesting chapter in the book, which was quite recently published by Susanna Pellingrea, with several important and interesting chapters by several prominent historians. So he was writing about Coven, who was working together with Tim Burns, the father of Jim Burns, who was doing a lecture here in end of February. So what he was writing is that, furthermore, in Madrid, Quesada has been in contact with a certain Howard Dennis Russell Coven. It would be very strange if Coven had not worked for MI6. Unfortunately, the MI6 records on the Spanish Civil War are completely inaccessible, and as long as they remain closed, it will be difficult to prove or to demolish these suspicions. Well, actually, the records are not closed, and I was talking to the official historian of MI6, Professor Keith Jeffrey, before his book was published, and I asked him, look, what are you going to write about the Spanish Civil War? And he, of course, did not tell me what would be in the book, but he told me, Boris, it's not going to be much, because there was not much. There was almost nothing. And it's only 6 pages about the Spanish Civil War, with this or this references, but in reality, indeed, MI6, or at the time MI1C, or Secret Intelligence Services, did not get any information. They had problems, by the way, a lot of problems. There was not enough stuff. The financing was very bad. They were suffering from lack of financing. And the official historian, previous historian of the Secret Service, Christoph Andrew, is writing that they had so little money that did not have enough money to buy wireless transmitters for their agents. The budget of Secret Intelligence Service is 1935 was £118,000, and they said we cannot do anything at all in Europe or anywhere in the world, and there was a decision to increase the budget, but because Secret Intelligence Service did not exist, they had to get funds from other ministries and secretly channel them into the Secret Intelligence Service. So they managed by 1937 to increase the budget to £250,000. 1937, £350,000. 1938, £450,000. And by the end of the Spanish Civil War, by April 1939, the budget of the Secret Intelligence Service was £500,000. Which again was not enough, and they simply could not afford any operations or any agents in Spain during the Spanish Civil War. So it's not a big secret, and it's not a big secrecy that so little is known about operations in Spain, because there were no, as I said, no operations. He continues. Coven, born on 23rd October 1883, joined the Foreign Office in September 1910. And was posted in Cuba. He resigned in October 20. His name re-emerged in the Foreign Service list as an honorary attaché in the embassy in Barcelona, which I could not find, in August 1938. He was in reality an integral member of the commission. There was a liaison commission by Field Marshal Sir Philip Chetwode, which was involved in the prisoners exchange. So Coven was working with a prisoner exchange in Spain. he's writing further that nothing is known about Cowan's activity during the critical period between March and August 1939. What is interesting in this text that he was writing that significantly, telegram sent by Patterson, who was the Sir Maurice Patterson, the ambassador at the time, on 23rd February 1940, included the statement, C informed, and he's writing further, C was of course standard shorthand for the head of MI6, and etc., 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 which was not true, probably, as you heard from Jim Burns, because C was also the name of Cowan. And in fact, together with Tim Burns, Cowan left Britain going for a mission, on a diplomatic mission, to Spain. But Duke of Alba, who was the ambassador in London, was very much against him because he was considered to be helping the Republicans during the Spanish Civil War. So he raised a scandal in the Foreign Office, and on the way he was stopped. Actually, they reached the Spanish border together with Tim Burns, and then he was informed officially by the Foreign Office, and the letter was signed by the ambassador, by Patterson, that he should not and must not go to Spain. So he was stopped on the border and had to return back to England, and that what was meaning by the note C is informed, no any relation to MI6. So apart from this unbelievable discovery that secret intelligence services was practically not involved in the Spanish Civil War, I found out one interesting thing. There's an interesting book written by another excellent historian on the Spanish Civil War, whose specialty is international brigades, and specifically British international brigades in the special civil, in the Spanish Civil War. And in his book, I found it an interesting piece. Before I read this piece, I must tell you that exactly 1.5 hour ago, I was having a very long talk with a Hollywood producer. And this Hollywood producer came here to London to work in the National Archives because he's writing a script for the future film about one person whom I don't know whether you know or not. His name is Alexander Alan Foote. Alexander Alan Foote is, among specialists, is rather a known figure. And this is what we read in this very, 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 very good book. Perhaps the most significant spy among the British veterans was Alex Foote. During his time in Spain, Foote had served as a driver for both Jock Cunningham. Jock Cunningham is Joseph Cunningham, who is a famous figure among the British Spanish war fighters. He became captain very quickly, and then he was one of the leaders of the British brigade in Spain. And Fred Koopman, another famous figure in the International Brigade, who became the commander of the British battalion, as far as I remember correctly. And as a courier between London and Spain, officially transporting Red Cross supplies through in reality carrying documents between King Street. King Street is the place where there was the headquarters of the Communist Party of Britain and the battalion's Communist Party command. Foote had been recruited by Red Army Intelligence at the end of the war, having been suggested as a possible foreign operative by Dave Springhall. Absolutely correct. In October 1938, he was given a passport and made contact with a handler in Geneva, known only as Sonia, who was, of course, Sonia was Ruth Kuczynski, a rather famous Soviet intelligence operator. She was a very and so-called illegal agent operating for the Russian military intelligence in Europe, Japan. She was working with Tsiorge, and later in London, handling very, very important agents. During the war, she was in charge of a very secretive spy network that was operating in Geneva, in Switzerland. So he was part became part of the Sonia's network in December 1940. Sonia departed for the UK, leaving Foote with ciphers and orders to continue transmissions and maintain contact with Alexander Rada. Chandra Rada, again, a Hungarian-born Soviet intelligence agent who was in charge of a very large Soviet intelligence network in Switzerland, which was known as Rote Drei, three, Red, Red Three. Between the fall of France in 1940 and the beginning of 1943, Foote was charged with learning German and building up a ring of reliable informants. However, by April 1943, he had become nervous that German intelligence had penetrated his cell, which is true. His suspicions were correct. Having identified Foote as Jim, the technical expert in the Russian intelligence network called Red 3, well, I told you Rote 3, which was supplying the Soviets with reports of military information from German-occupied areas, German agents tipped off the Swiss authorities, and they arrested Foote. He was arrested by the Swiss police at the end of November 1943 for using clandestine wireless transmission set. Foote was released on 8 September 1944, with Russian intelligence cautious as ever, keen to be sure he was a British agent. He was flown to Moscow for interrogation and then posted back to Berlin with the aim of gaining German background before going to Argentina to work against the United States. That is correct. However, while in Berlin, Foote approached British intelligence staff, claiming that he no longer worked for the Russians and wanted to work for the British instead. The British officer interviewing him didn't believe a word of it, seeing in Foote only a very sick man, tired of playing for the Russians, wanting to go home to England and write an interesting book, which he finally did, writing a book, which was published in London in 1949, and it is a very famous book. So what we did a couple of hours ago with the Hollywood producer, we were discussing Alan Foote, and he was asking me for several details, and I explained to him that, of course, there is a specialist in Alexander Foote who studied his recently declassified MI5 file, which is Cave 2-1611, consisting of six volumes, which, of course, is the result of interrogations showing how much Foote told British interrogators, how much he said about his activities with Russian intelligence, and he was actually involved with Russian intelligence for almost 10 years. But what I found out, that in July 1936, MI6, or SIS, was entirely unsatisfied with what was going on inside the organization, and a very secret organization, very typical to this country, was created so deeply inside SIS that no one knew about it. The organization was headed by a person whose name is Colonel Claude Dancey, who was head of station in Rome and an absolutely fascinating personality. I collected a small collection of texts or expressions about Sir Claude Dancey, who at the end of his career was the second in command of the whole Secret Intelligence Service in London. Officially, he was dismissed from the service, persecuted in 1936. In reality, he headed this most secret British intelligence organization, which was located here in Bush House on the 8th floor. On the right side, there was the Russian news agency TASS. On the left side from his office was the British Worldwide BBC Worldwide Service. The Russian service was not broadcasting at the time. They came to exactly the same place 10 years later in 1946. But the whole most secret British intelligence organization was just around the corner here in Bush House. So about Claude Dancey, Lord Grace, better known as the historian Trevor Loper, who served in British intelligence service. He was writing, Claude Dancey was an utter shit, corrupt, incompetent, but with a certain low cunning. Another famous person whose name is Victor Cavendish Bentinck, who was the chairman, wartime chairman, of Joint Intelligence Committee, and later was better known as Duke of Portland. He was writing, "A downy old bird, very good at his job." Malcolm Muggeridge, a well-known British correspondent journalist who for a long time worked with Alan Foote after Alan Foote returned from his assignment in Russia. So Muggeridge was writing about Claude Dancy, the only real professional in MI6. The others at the top were all second-rate minds. Edward Crankshaw, a British journalist, writer and author, who was specializing in Soviet affairs, was writing, "Dancy, a sort of man who gives spying a bad name." And the deputy, former deputy of Colonel Dancy, Lieutenant Commander Kenneth Cohen, who was recruited in very mysterious circumstances and became second in command. The code name for Dancy was Zed, so the organization was called Zed Organization, and Conan was codenamed Z2. So he was writing about his boss. He was writing, "A copybook secret service man, DAPA, establishment, Boodles is the club on St. James's, you know, probably. Poker playing expression, bitterly cynical, but with unlimited and illogical charm available particularly for women." Lieutenant Colonel Claude Dancy, KCMG, commander of the Legion d'honneur of France, officer of the Legion of Merit of the United States, all highest decoration imaginable. In 1936, at the end of 1936, he created the most secret, as I said, organization which operated with non-professionals. It employed 200 agents, all of them very famous people, Peter Korda, film producer, and his film productions, London Film Productions, was the front for that organization. Robert Bosch, the founder of the famous Bosch company of house electronics. One of the most productive agents of the group, recruited in December 1936, was Alexander Alan Foote, who was the British spy, working for that organization for 10 years. Actually, which is not reflected in his MI5 file, and it is strange to read all what he was telling, because his real mission, as we know today, as a courier between Barcelona, Valencia and London, was to bring intelligence to Claude Dancy about the situation in the Republican camp. And this what stands behind a very small phrase in Keith Jeffrey's official history of MI6, who is saying that we had some information from the Republican camp, but we lacked any information from the Franco side, and they were struggling to get any information from Franco side. So this small and unimportant phrase that means a lot for those who know about Z organization, which was, of course, the main target for the organization was to operate against Nazi Germany and Italy. A big part of it was based in Switzerland. Actually, Claude Dancy wanted to change his headquarters. He wanted to leave London at the end of the war and come and make his headquarters in Zurich. What is more fascinating is a famous Russian spy ring, which was called the Lucy Ring, which was run by Rasha Dubendorfer with her boyfriend. And there were three big Russian networks working for Russian military intelligence during the Civil War. So the Lucy spy ring, and specifically Rachel Dubendorfer, who was German, they were all supplied with intelligence coming from London. She was also working for British intelligence. And there was one famous man whose name is Victor Farrell, who was part of Claude Dancy network, and he was an active agent of Z organization, who was supplying to Switzerland, to this Russian intelligence firing, all information that was coming from Ultra and from all British intelligence intercepts that were done by the government code and cipher school at the time, who were intercepting all communications from Germans and Italians. And they were feeding Russian intelligence, Russian military intelligence, with this information via Foote and via Dubendorfer. So they were actively involved with it. It was truly true information. It was not deception, actually. They were supplying a lot of important information for the Russians. But if the Russians knew that this information was coming from the British intelligence, they would probably not accept it or act in a different way. Another interesting thing that I found working on the subject was a letter that Paul Preston published in his famous book, The Spanish Civil War, that you all know, of course. I never knew about this letter, and this is the letter with which he ends his chapter. Also a very interesting chapter, exactly about the period I am talking about. The chapter is called Behind the Gentleman's Agreement, and this is the letter, this is the article, actually, not the letter, the article that Winston Churchill published in the Daily Telegraph on 30th December 1938. He wrote, "It must be admitted that if at this moment the Spanish government were victorious, they would be so anxious to live on friendly terms with Great Britain. They would find so much sympathy among the British people for them, so we should probably be able to dissuade them from the vengeance which would have attended their early triumph in the struggle. On the other hand, if Franco won, his Nazi backers would drive him to the same kind of brutal suppression as the practice by totalitarian states. The victory of the Spanish Republic would therefore not only be a strategic security for British imperial communications throughout the Mediterranean, but gentler and reconciling force would play a larger part." And he further writes in the article that nothing has strengthened the Prime Minister's hold upon well-to-do society more remarkably than the belief that he is friendly to General Franco and the nationalist cause in Spain. But this sentiment on either side may be pushed beyond the bounds of British interest. It would seem that today the British Empire would run far less risk from the victory of the Spanish government than from that of General Franco. And with these very prophetic words, I want to finish my talk today, and you are very welcome with your questions.
Boris, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. That's absolutely fascinating, to add to the fascinations that you've exercised for us and myself over the years. Now, the conundrum you refer to in the title, presumably this refers to the real lack of concern of the Allied intelligence.
Absolutely correct.
And indeed, the Allied governments, in knowing more than very, very basic information about intelligence. Now, why? Why were they not interested, for example, in what was evidently taking place? That was a rapprochement between fascist Italy and Nazi Germany in the Spanish Civil War, because they weren't aligned fully before then. So why this lack of interest in the political aspects?
There was no any interest in the political aspect, because from the very beginning they understood very well that they do not want, and that's written in millions, hundreds of thousands of documents, that they were afraid that Spain would become communist. They didn't want it. They didn't want any communist social revolution. They were considering Largo Caballero as the Spanish Lenin, as you all well know, and that there are all communists at power, that Russia is supporting them, and that Spain would become communist, so it's better. And they all knew before that there should be a revolt. And of course, they were all on Franco's side. So they were absolutely uninterested. What they were interested in, they were interested to make peace with Germany and Italy, not to direct Germany and Italy against Britain, but against Russia and Eastern Europe. And they knew very well about Czechoslovakia, knew very well about Poland, and about Austria, and it didn't matter for them, and they didn't mind very much. So their only interest was not to make Spain communist. About their lack of taking any lessons of the Spanish Civil War, the popular phrase of the, for example, British Air Ministry was, this is not information that the first-rate powers should be taking into account before they start war activities. So whatever was going in this second-rate market with this second-rate country and the second-rate war was of no interest, because that was nothing that a supreme power would take into account in their activities. That's why they were not even interested in the intelligence that was coming from Spain. And there was very little intelligence coming anyway. But this is little known, and therefore the conundrum. Everything, all what I'm talking today is almost unknown, which is strange.
Well, I have many more questions, but I must open it up to the audience here. So please, can we have the first question? Oh, I thought I saw a flicker. Yeah, right. Richard.
My question is on a kind of different type of intelligence, in a way. Given that 2,500 people left here to go to Spain, the majority of whom were in the Communist Party, and that the British security services were spending considerable time panicking about communists in the UK, and here they are in Spain learning military tactics, how to use weapons. How much effort did they make to actually try and infiltrate the brigades, to get people over there, to find out exactly what's going on?
No, any attempts at all.
Nothing at all?
Nothing at all. Absolutely nothing. They did nothing. They didn't care about it, absolutely. What they did care about, people who were coming back from Spain.
Yeah.
That was the biggest concern. This is a different pair of shoes. Absolutely. Whoever was going to Spain, whatever they were doing there, dying or advancing or whatever, no interest. The biggest interest, and that was of course the interest not of SIS, that was the interest of MI5, as you well know.
Yes.
What they were going to do back in this country, where they're going to start communist propaganda, subversion, whether they were going to work on Russia, and there were a lot of cases, because what the Russians were doing, they were doing two things. Besides getting interest of all technical sides of the military conflict, Italians and Germans and whatever, they were massively recruiting people to work in the United States and in Europe. Massively. We are talking about probably not hundreds, but thousands of agents who were recruited during the Spanish Civil War among international brigades, who were successfully operated for Russia for many, many years to come, until our time, actually. So the biggest interest of the British services were what people coming back from Spain were doing in this country, how they were involved, whether they were recruited or not. And they found several agents, as you well know. Springhall was arrested, as you well know. Oliver was arrested. There were quite several cases when people were indeed recruited from the communist ranks, or even non-communist ranks, coming to this country as spies already. They were traced, because best of all, MI5 was of course settled here in this country. They had enough agents and informants operating within the Communist Party, within those who were interested in Russia. They were absolutely uninterested, which is a shame and a big tragedy. And for example, in the Austrian circles, and there was a huge Austrian group of Austrian communists and non-communists operating in this country during the war. Many of them were Russian agents. Many were Russian illegals. And some people like Arnold Deutsch, for example, Dr. Deutsch, he was the main recruiter of what later became known as the Cambridge Spy Ring. And I'm not using the term Cambridge Five, a popular term, because this is not true. Because in 1945, there was a Russian defector named Konstantin Volkov, who was ready to give to the British side 250 Russian agents operating in this country by 1945. And I was when I was tracing the files, and they are in the book by file numbers, I found out that between the third member of the Spanish Cambridge Five, which was Blunt, and the fourth member, there were 75 agents recruited. And altogether, as I said, there were about 250 agents. So when we talk about what somebody was talking, I'm fighting this, about Cambridge Five, this is not true. There were three people, McLean, Burgess and Philby, who could have been considered as the Cambridge Three. Again, they were not operating together. They knew each other. Most of the Cambridge students of the same year knew each other. So Cambridge Five did not exist. There were a lot of Russian agents operating in this country in the 30s, of which MI5 had no idea at all, because the first and only thing they were interested in is not even political intelligence, but Russian communist subversion, more or less nothing else.
Yes?
Jim Brandt spoke about Kim Philby being in Spain. What did you find out about him?
Oh yes, a lot. Everything is known about Kim Philby in Spain. As you know, he was sent as the Times correspondent. He was sent as another correspondent, but then he became a Times war correspondent. He was sent... Russians influenced very much of him being sent. You should not confuse Kim Philby of 1937 and Kim Philby of 1963. There were different Kim Philbys. And Kim Philby, as head of British station of SIS station in Washington, is not a Kim Philby who was sent to Spain. He was junior recruit, and there were ideas of the Russian, as I'm writing in the book, Stalin's agent. There were ideas of sending him to Franco to assassinate Franco, which was a very stupid idea. He was not able to assassinate anybody, and he was not able to come close to Franco. But in terms of a good reporting, that was good reporting if somebody was sent from London to assassinate Franco. There were a couple of other attempts from Moscow until middle of 1937, when the order came from the Kremlin to stop any attempts. The same was with Hitler, actually. There were two groups who were sent to Berlin to assassinate Hitler, and then the order came. They were very close. And one of them was a very famous movie actress, Olga Chekhova, who came very close and whose portrait, together with Hitler, in the opera is placed on the book by Anthony Beaver. So she was one of the Soviet intelligence operators who was supposed to kill Hitler. But then the order came from Moscow not to do it. The same was with Franco. The order came not to do anything against Franco. But this is of course a wrong rumor and a false idea that Russians were interested in the prolongation of the Spanish Civil War as long as possible. This is not true. Like any writings by for example Robert Conquest and Robert Service is absolutely not true. It's a full invention. And this is I wanted actually to talk to you a little bit about literature. There's several kinds of literatures that I would very much recommend you not to read. One is the Cold War literature, which is it's impossible to read it today. It's complete rubbish, and unfortunately that comes back again as we are living in the period of the Second Cold War today. This kind of literature is appearing again, and it's entirely impossible. I was reading the book by Ben McIntyre, the spine, the traitor. It's horrible. The same Mark Urban about the Skripal case. Impossible. It's impossible to read Robert Service today. Impossible to read Robert Conquest. When they're writing, the thousands of POEM members were assassinated in Spain. This is bullshit. This is rubbish. The only person who was killed is Andrew Nin. Again, it was a chance. They were absolutely sure that they would persuade him to admit that he was working for Franco. And, of course, it was crazy to think so. They prepared a nice file, well done, showing him as the Franco spy. Nobody believed that, of course, and they had to get rid of him, so he was assassinated. But among all those who were arrested in the POUM, in the Partido Obrero, Unificación Marxista, that's the only person who suffered. Few were arrested, but then they were released from prison. No one was assassinated, to the best of my knowledge. So when we're reading about 1,000 killed, this is stupidity. Another kind of literature, of which you probably don't know, is the so-called defect literature. It's the book that have been written by Russian defectors, those Russian intelligence officers who defected to the West and were helped by the security service and intelligence service to write books. Again, it's impossible to use them, simply. The books are written by Alexander Orlov, and he wrote 3 books, in fact. Nothing is true, absolutely nothing. In the Krivitsky's book, I was Stalin's agent. Not a word is true. Nothing at all. It's all done, it's propaganda books where all inventions are present. They were written by the commission of security service or intelligence service, and you cannot take them for granted. It's false. It's false literature. It's false history. There's also some interesting phenomenon in literature. The books, which is very much biased. I mean, somebody like Ronald Radish, for example. He went to Russia. Perfect thing. He went to Russia. He obtained by this or that ways several very, very interesting Russian documents. He published those documents in the book, but he made comments to those documents. And the comments are terrible because they're very much biased and they are very much untrue and incorrect. And when I studied Russian documents that were basis for his translations, I found on plenty of mistakes in the translations. And of course, all his interpretation of those documents are again false. I realize perfectly well that for anybody who is not a specialist, who is not spending day and nights reading books and documents, it's very difficult to differentiate what is good or not, especially in history. But as I said, the target and the aim of the government is not to show but to conceal the truth. And I will repeat that again, that the basis for any intelligence organization and of the government which is controlling the intelligence organization is secrecy and deception. And please do not forget that.
Yes, Michael.
I was going to ask about Philby, but I was going to ask something else. What we read is that Philby was planted, as it were, in the Franco zone and sent information. Have you ever seen anything that Philby said? How did he convey it? Did he go across the frontier or something? I think I've read somewhere. What did he actually report on? What information did he give, if any?
He did not report anything. And he was not even supposed to report. That was the only thing. He was supposed to come as close as possible to Franco's nearest circles. That was all. And he was to report on the atmosphere in Franco's Spain. That is all. If you are referring to Deadly Illusions, written by Tsaryov and Castello, which is a bad book. For many reasons. And one of the reasons is, if you were reading that attentively, you might have noticed that that he was traveling to France to report is not right. He didn't have any possibility to travel there, and especially the Russians, there were only 3 operators in Russia, Russian operators in France. They had absolutely no opportunity to go and talk to a boy about what? What could he relay to them? 3 agents in the whole Russian station in Paris at the time.
So
no chance.
There. No experience. He wasn't an assassin.
Because he just was going as a correspondent. And at the same time, he was already recruited to Russian intelligence. So they wanted to put that together, to combine pleasure and business. That's it. Nothing special. He was supposed to report by writing postcards to the Russian embassy in Paris. Postcards. I mean, how much information can you put on a postcard? Because it's like every 10th letter was meaning something. So how many 10th letters can you put on an open postcard to relay intelligence information? One word, one phrase maximum. That's it. And what could he report? Nothing at all. But from the Francophone, there was very little information. Even the British intelligence, as I said, even those who were coming, like Commander James, for example, who was the Member of Parliament, he was visiting Francophone regularly. And he was telling the British Air Ministry, War Office, and others about his impressions. But what could he say, actually? He was making a tour, seeing a few people, talking to a few people, and 3 days leaving. This is not the way to collect intelligence. So Philby was in no way able to collect any intelligence at all. It was just good reporting. You know, good reporting, we have somebody on the Franco side. Nothing else.
Any other questions? Yes.
Just a comment, really. You mentioned Norman King, and I've got an interest here because he was a predecessor of mine, because I was consul general in Barcelona from 2002 to 2000. Anyway, so I never had a chance to meet Norman. But he was there for 10 years, and you referred to him as, you know, the very famous, influential, or whatever. He would have been in Barcelona during the Civil War, within the Civil War. When forces were fighting each other on the streets of Barcelona, or ostensibly on the anti-Franco side, whether regard to Republicans or not, is immaterial. Now, surely, the kind of reports that he would be putting back, there's always a fine line between political reporting and intelligence. If you're there for some time, you can report exactly what's happening, but at the same time, you can give your opinion. Now, whether that is intelligence or not, as you interpret it, I don't know. But you referred to him as being infamous or famous or whatever. Why do you say that?
I say that for two reasons. First of all, that he was famous and he was reporting a lot. He was famous because he spent 12 years in Barcelona as the British consul. He was reporting a lot. There's plenty of his reports published and in the archives. But one thing we have to have in mind about Norman King is that he was absolutely and entirely pro-Franco.
Yes, definitely.
And so all his reporting, this is intelligence. All kind of diplomatic reporting is intelligence, because intelligence is information, right? So that was information. And at the same time, intelligence. Whatever he was reporting, he was not interested to report anything which was not pro-Republican and anti-Franco. He was typically pro-Franco, reporting anything what he considered is important to have in the Foreign Office from his point of view. When Admiral Backhouse came to Barcelona and Valencia on an official visit, he was referring to the views of Norman King, saying in his official report, which is published widely, saying that, of course, a preferable partner for us, Germany and Italy, rather than the communist Spain. So we should ignore communist Spain, and Norman King is right when he's supporting this point of view. That was Admiral Backhouse writing. Reports by Norman King as being a report from the place, he was an agent in place, as it's called in the intelligence service, are important and interesting, but we have to have in mind his bias.
Yes.
And this is what...
He wasn't
a neutral observer. And this is the most interesting thing, and this is the most tricky thing, that everybody, or many people, had to take sides in the Spanish Civil War. And Tom Buchanan is right, saying that there was a huge sympathy in this country to the events in Spain, which is absolutely true until this day, as we see from this audience. There's a lot of people who want to listen something about the Spanish Civil War. There was huge sympathy for the events in Spain, unusual for the British people, but of course the British society, as much as the society in Gibraltar, on the British overseas territories,
and as much as the people in Spain were, of course, divided between those who supported Franco and who were thinking that his regime is right for Spain and correct thing to be friends with and good for Britain, because Britain, as you well know, had huge interest, 40% of investment, financial investments made in Spain. Industrial exchange, plenty of industries were under British control, etc., etc. You all know that very well. And there was another part who was pro-Republican, but then again, this is also biased. I mean, one was the socialist side, or communist, pro-communist, pro-socialist side, another was pro-Franco side. When we're talking about neutral reporters, I do not actually have any in the archives or in published literature. And only these days, in the past 10 years, 12 years probably, there comes a literature on the Spanish Civil War which is very much balanced, which is taking into account this and that side, which is taking into account the latest research in many fields of history. And the books, even I'm judging by the books by Paul Preston, who are very much different from the books that were published 25 or 30 years ago. It's a very balanced approach, very professional, very interesting, taking into account many, many sides, because this is not a simple story. Of course, one cannot be either this or that side.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Several years ago, even more than 10 years ago, Ernest Hemingway's stories about Spain, Spanish Spain, was a story about the NKVD people in leather jackets who disposed of people among the Republicans.
Ernest Hemingway, in his most famous book, For Whom the Bell Tolls, is writing about Spain because he was on the Republican side. He was taken by Mamsurov, who was the guerrilla commander, to the partisan detachment. So he was writing a lot about the Spanish Civil War, about events on the Republican side. It's not taken into consideration that Ernest Hemingway was the Russian spy, fully recruited Russian spy, who worked for NKVD there. He was delivering information. At the time, he started to report directly and wittingly, probably already from Cuba. So when the Spanish Civil War events were taking place, he was just an observer who was very much sympathetic to the Republican cause. So all what he was writing was pro-Republican, and he was, of course, depicting Russians as they were, wearing leather jackets and fighting fascists, which is normal.
The Russians.
There were a few Russians, not a few. There were so-called white Russians coming from Paris, who were on the Franco side, and there were a few hundred people who were, of course, who were running out of Russia because of the Bolshevik Revolution. There were white guards. They were very much anti-communist and anti-Reds, and they were having formations that were under the Franco forces, and they were fighting Russians. This is true. This is true.
Could I perhaps? We have one other person, and I think we will then run out of questions. I'm afraid we'll have to close down because it's almost 7:30. You had a question there, yes?
There must have been a small Secret Service presence in Spain at that time. You mentioned Gibraltar. I have family connections down there, but was there a naval presence there? Was there a military presence at all during that time in Gibraltar?
British naval presence?
Yes. Was there military at all there, as well as the Secret Service that they were in the mainland Spain? Was there anything in Gibraltar?
Absolutely. There are two fascinating books written on Gibraltar. One is specifying on this period. I shall very much recommend you to read that. Yes, there's a popular opinion that British fleet was based in Gibraltar, which is not true. Basically, British fleet was based in Malta, and then during the events it was moved to Alexandria, to Egypt. And then in, I don't remember exactly, in 36, I believe, or 37, it was returned to Malta. It's considered wrongly that that was a huge naval base. There was a naval base indeed in Gibraltar. It was a small naval base, and patrolling of the waters of the opposite side, which is Algeciras, was done by the British fleet, small British fleet from Gibraltar. In Gibraltar, there were plenty of refugees coming from the wartime Spain, from both sides. So there were thousands of people coming to Gibraltar, staying there for a while. Some of them, when Franco took over in 39, they returned from Spain. But there were no clashes. Also, the society in Gibraltar was divided, as in Spain, and in this country, between two, pro-Franco and anti-Franco, pro-Republicans. But as I said, there was a small naval base. It was modernized in 45 to become the British defense base in Gibraltar.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid we have to draw this to a close. I know there's lots more to be said, lots more to ask Boris. Could you join me in thanking Boris for this absolutely fascinating talk?
Thank you very much indeed.